Happy Friday, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. You know, sometimes the moon aligns with Mars, and the publicity and the publishing gods smile down on my little part of the world and give me a guest so spectacular that it almost takes my breath away. Margaret Maron is one of those guests. She's written over 27 novels, I think more than that now, and has two collections of short stories. She has won every major award for crime fiction, including the Edgar, the Anthony, the Agatha, the McCavity. Her works are on the reading lists of various courses in contemporary Southern literature. They've been translated into 15 languages. She served as president of Sisters in Crime, the American Crime Writers League, Mystery Writers of America, and she is with me tonight. I am most honored to introduce all of you to Miss Margaret Maron. Margaret, welcome to Authors on the Air, and thank you so much for being with me tonight.
Well, thank you, Pam. It's fun. So here I am in North Carolina, but I'm also in Florida.
Yes, you are. And isn't that interesting? Because while we were sitting in the green room, we were talking about how there are so many of us Floridians up there invading your North Carolina as well. We kind of have a symbiotic relationship, our states, don't we?
Yes, we do. It was funny because actually I had a book called High Country Fall, which was set up in the mountains of North Carolina, and I wanted to call it The Mountains of Florida. And my editor gave me a weird look, and she said, Florida doesn't have any mountains, and this book is not about Florida anyhow. And I said, Florida has beautiful mountains. They just happen to lie in North Carolina because we get so many Floridians in the summertime up here.
Of course
but
you
she
do,
didn't
because
quite
who wants to be in 100-degree weather every day and all the humidity and thunderstorms and hurricanes? So, you know, unlike yours truly, who was born and raised in Miami and now is on the Southwest Coast, doesn't matter, it's still nasty out. But I'm so honored that you're here. I'm thrilled. North Carolina is beautiful. Have you always lived there, Margaret, or have you made
your
home? Yes,
I have. I am a native Tar Heel, born and bred in this briar patches, they say. Yes, I've been here my whole life. Well, I mean, no, not my whole life, because I lived for several years after I married my husband. We lived in Naples, Italy for 3 years, and then we lived in his native town, which was Brooklyn, and we lived there for about 10 years. And then I said, well, let's just go try North Carolina for 7 years. Like, I've spent 7 years up here, let's go do 7 years in North Carolina. Well, that was 40 years ago. We're still not telling him that the 7 years is up.
Oh, no. As long as he doesn't ask any questions, there's no reason to mention anything to him.
Yeah.
Is your husband, perchance, a writer also?
No, he's an artist. He is a studio artist and paints beautiful pictures. And actually, he is the reason that I wrote the first Sigrid Harrell book, which takes place in a New York City art department, college art department. And I was working there as a part-time secretary. I was a replacement for the secretary who had taken a leave of absence, the departmental secretary. And I was fascinated by the way the poisons and the acids and all of these really horrible substances were treated in such a cavalier manner. Supposedly, the students would come and they would have permission to sign out some acids for etching a copper plate or a tin plate or something. And supposedly, they would come back and sign out and bring the key back and sign it back in. But in reality, I would have to go looking for the key at the end of the day. And I thought, boy, you know, I looked at all those chemicals that were used in those days and still are for etching, but they had also all this photography chemicals and everything.
Right.
And there was one in particular that just fascinated me, potassium dichromate. And it's used for etching plates. And the thing about it is it makes beautiful art, but it does horrible things to the human throat. And I thought, well, what if I had somebody put some of that in a cup of coffee meant for this particular professor that I myself did not particularly care for? And that's where that first book came from.
Had you planned on writing a book at that point in your life, or were you already writing a book, Margaret?
No, 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 no. So many writers have two or three books in their file cabinets that they learned how to write on, and I do not. I have no unpublished books in my files. I do have some unfinished short stories, and that's what I started at. I actually wanted to be a poet, and the next thing when I knew that I could not make a living writing poetry, very few people make a living writing poetry.
Right.
They have to teach and, you know, do other things too. So I decided that I would write short stories, and my short stories are really pretty short. But then the short story market dried up during that time, and we were down to, I mean, the women's magazines, I had stories in McCall's and Good Housekeeping and Red Book and all those wonderful old magazines. Yeah. And
I love all those. My mother got them, not that I know anything.
Yeah. They used to have a short story issue every August, and they would publish six or eight short stories, really short, one page, two pages. And so they bought some of mine. And they were fun to write, and I liked the money. They paid certainly better than the mystery magazines paid. And that was the object. I mean, one writes for self-expression, but I also wanted to earn a living at it. So when the mystery, I was selling occasionally to the mystery magazines, and then they got to the point that there were really only two, Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock. Really,
right.
The only two that were doing anything. And so I had a short story that didn't sell to either of those magazines. But I knew that Alfred Hitchcock occasionally published a novelette, so I thought, well, I'll just double this story into a novelette. And they didn't buy it either. So I thought, well, I was really getting interested in it, and the male protagonist had a sex change operation and turned into Lieutenant Sigrid Harold instead of Peter Boor. That was my character's original name. And I decided I really couldn't write from a male viewpoint, that I would be more comfortable. I knew it was going to be a series. And so I doubled it into a book-length novelette, and I sent it off to an agent that someone had recommended. And he got right back to me, and he said, well, I like this character. I like the way you write. I like the plot. But it's too short. Nobody's buying novelettes. Now, if you could double it. So once again, I doubled it. And that was was my first book. Yeah.
How interesting to me that you not only were exceptionally creative, you knew exactly what you wanted to do and had to do, but you also kept in mind that you were creating a marketable product, because
by the time it turned into a full-length book, I really was starting to be interested in this character, and I decided that she is a homicide detective, police lieutenant for the city of New York, and I wanted to do 1 year in her life, and I start with. Each book can stand alone, but you get a little bit more of the background and the mystery of what happened to her father and what was going on in her parents' relationship. And that is the overarching arc that runs through the first eight books. And we find out in the end all about the circumstances surrounding her father's death and her mother's affair with her boss. And then I thought I was finished with her. I thought that was the end of it. But it turned out not to be, because now we have takeout.
Yeah, I want to ask you, how did you learn to write? Because short stories are one thing, and poetry is one thing. I know that there are creative writing classes, and I know many, many people who write short stories and poems, and they're quite good. But they're not published, and they would never attempt to write a book. How did you learn
how to write a full-length novel? Had you gone to school for that?
No, no. And I do not have any, well, I have a couple of, I have an honorary degree, but I don't have a bachelor's degree. I went 2 years, and then I dropped out to get married and never went back. But when I was trying to write and learning my craft, we were in Brooklyn, and I gave myself, because I'd never had any writing courses, so I gave myself a writing course out of the Brooklyn Public Library. And I also subscribed to a magazine called The Writer. And that was very, very helpful because it came every month and it would give me a kickstart and it would inspire me to keep trying. So it took about 2 years before I wrote something that somebody bought. And I'm going to tell you, Pam, absolutely nothing validates you like getting a check from somebody who's no blood kin to you.
I love that. Margaret, that's great. I bet you you're right. You know, it's kind of like getting a tax return, a refund.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Well, so you must have, though, always been a reader because you understood the structure of a story or a poem or a short story well enough. And by the by, I want to say right now that in my humble opinion, someone who can write a full story within a short, whether it's 2,500 words or 5,000 words or 7,000 words, which, you know, is generally the range, I guess, now.
Mm-hmm.
If you can write a story within that confine, that says something
mm-hmm.
about the quality of a writer, I believe one is. So, you know, and I'm not trying to say that, oh, you know, you've done all this. You obviously had writing chops, and you obviously were dedicated enough to it that you sat down and said, well, you know, I think I'm going to try that. And isn't that what all teachers tell writing students? Put your butt in a chair and write.
Yes, and write, yes. I have given writing courses over the years and gone to seminars and talked to would-be writers. And I always get discouraged when they say, well, you know, now, do I have to worry about getting my work copyrighted so that I can be protected? And I have to say, honey, nobody's going to steal your work. And even if it's wonderful.
And
the thing is, they want to know about how to get an agent and an editor before they've written anything. Before they finished something. I have gone to writers' conferences and read a first chapter or the beginning of a short story that just blew me away. And then the next time I saw that person and I would say, well, you know, did you finish the book? How is it? She said, well, no, I got bored with it and I've started something else. But I think it's going to be wonderful.
Oh.
And they never really finished anything. And you've
got
to finish something. An agent is look at a half-finished book.
Well, right, exactly. You know, so let me paint a little scenario for you. I was visiting a friend in her office, and one of the partners in this financial firm came out and said, oh, I love to read, and I'm writing a book because they know that I have a radio show, and I speak to wonderful authors. And he said, and I said, oh, well, that's great. You know, what have you written? He says, well, mostly short stories. And I said, well, that's terrific. He says, but I want to write a book. And I said, well, sit down and write a book. And he says, but I don't know where to start. How do I start? And I looked at him and I thought, I'm a radio talk show host and a reader, but I know well enough to say, plant your butt in the chair and start
mm-hmm.
writing. And he says, I can't get my thoughts down. And I said, well, some people just kind of write by instinct, others kind of make an outline. And so it was one excuse after the other. And I thought, he says, well, can you give me some ideas? And I said, no, I'm not a writer. You know? And I fully admit that. Everybody in the network, except for me, is a writer. So you know, I'm the reader in the group. But it's frustrating when you see that, isn't it? Especially when you see someone with talent, because I would imagine, let's say, in a classroom of 50 people, you probably have maybe two or three, if you're lucky, who
mm-hmm.
really show some talent. Wouldn't you think, Margaret?
Yes. Yes.
So, and when they don't act on it, it kind of feels like, you know, it's gone. It's gone. And that's so sad,
yeah,
because we need talented writers to continue to come into the market and provide this
absolutely
wonderful entertainment.
Oh, yeah. Well, you were asking before about how a short story writer goes to a book. And I would like to tell you, for me, the short story was plot. You know, I would think up a plot, and I would think up a twist. And I'm not an outliner, but I would have a pretty good idea of where the plot was going to go. And then I would create the characters who could jump through the hoops that I was setting for them. But when I started writing the book, I discovered that books are more about character than plot. And I had intended for, I thought I knew who the killer was, who was going to put the poison in the deputy chairman's coffee. And when it got time for her to do the deed, she wouldn't do it. I mean, I had created a character who said, I'm not that kind of girl. And she was right. She was not that kind of girl. Now, I could have gone back and made, I could have forced her to do it, which would have been out of character and would have been terribly apparent. Or I could have gone back and changed her character so that she was that kind of person. Or what actually happened was that I looked around through the cast of characters and there was a guy sitting at the back and he raised his hand and said, I'll be your killer. And not only did he have a better method, he had a better motive. And so I've never worried about it after that. I've often started a book and not known who the killer was, had a general idea of where I was going with it and what I wanted to say, what I wanted to accomplish. But, for instance, one of my books was set down at the coast with all the different things that were pulling at the North Carolina waters then. And the killer changed four times in that book. And I didn't have to go back and rewrite too much of it because, you know, when you're writing a murder mystery, you just spread suspicion everywhere. And characters
absolutely
kept showing up with better motives and more realistic motives. And I just let them run with it.
It's kind of like peeling the onion, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Yes,
I
all those layers,
that.
And you don't know what's going to show up. I mean, peeling the onion might not be the perfect analogy,
right,
but it is. It's you know, getting further and further. Well, Doctorow, I think it was, who said E.L. Doctorow. He said,
right,
I don't think he ever outlined. He said, I just start writing. It's like driving a car on a dark night. You can only see as far as your headlights go. But if you keep driving, the headlights keep revealing more and more of the road that you're taking.
Oh, I like
and
that. I like that.
I do, too. I like that very much because that's really pretty much the way I work.
Wow. I really like that a lot, as a matter of fact. I want to talk about Takeout. I'm not quite sure which number book, full-length book, this is, because your website says you've got 27 full-length novels under your belt, but I bet you anything there are more. So,
I may need to update that. Yeah, there are 31 books.
You may
books
need to. Yeah, I
there
thought
are 31
so
novels, and then there are there are 31 novels, 20 of the Deborah Knott books, 9 of the Sigrid Harrell books, 2 standalones, and then 2 collections of short stories. I know that because I'm looking at the list right here in front of me.
There you go. So I have a couple questions, and I they're going to kind of maybe be rapid fire or not. But first of all, how do you title your characters? How do you name your characters?
Okay. I was talking about that with someone just yesterday, and I really don't get a handle on the character until I can name it. And so sometimes the name comes spontaneously. Sometimes I have to sit and read through Name Your Baby, you know, that book from the 50s or 60s, about the different meanings of the different names and everything. And then if it's someone with an ethnic background of some sort, I go and I say, you know, give me some Italian names, thank goodness for Google.
Right.
You know, you
Google,
can say Italian
right?
surnames, Italian surnames, Polish surnames, you know, Scottish surnames, whatever is necessary. And between those two sources, I wind up naming my characters. And once I have their names, then I start feeling as if I know them, you know?
Does an image form for you when you name your characters?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I can't say, I mean, this really is the indefinable part of it. I can't really tell you what it is that I see, although until I started keeping a list of all the names that I've used over the years, I discovered that I really liked the name Anne, and I named a lot of my female characters Anne until I started realizing what I was doing about the second and third book. And
right, your character Bible is saying, no, you can't go there again.
Yeah.
You're going to confuse everyone. Right.
Right, right.
That's funny. Well, thank you. My middle name is Anne, so I'm glad you like it.
Oh. Well, I printed out, now that the books are winding down and everything, I printed out my character list a couple of days ago. And the Deborah Knott ones took 28 pages, single space, 9 font. And the Sigrids... And the Sigrids took about, I think about 15 pages. Yeah.
Oh,
well, I enter each name twice. I do by the surname and by the first name. And at the surname entry, that's when I say, you know, that she has blue eyes and drives a red Mercedes and hates the color brown and can't stand onions. Anything that I have said. Because
right, the character.
Are you familiar
sure.
with Joan Hess's books, her Maggoty
books? Of course.
Books?
Sure.
Well, Joan was telling me one day when I was bragging to her about how I was keeping all my characters straight. She said, "Well, she had decided to go back and try to list all of her characters." And she said, "So I'm working on my 8th book in this particular series, and I discovered that one of the characters was killed in the 2nd book." That will throw a wrench
right.
into your list.
Yeah.
But nobody had ever pointed that out, and so she just ran with it.
But you know there will be somebody who comes along and says, "Oh, by the way, did you know?"
Oh, yeah.
Because
readers
are sharp like that.
I know, and they're wonderful that way. In fact, I just had somebody tell me of an error in Takeout, which neither I nor my first readers nor my editor nor the copy editor, nobody spotted it, but she did right away. And on one page, I say something about the yellow Lady Banks roses, and 4 pages later, I say something about the white roses. So when we do the paperback... Like one, the white is going to come out and it's going to be yellow roses.
Isn't it funny? You know, I'm slightly dyslexic, so when I write, things, especially numbers, get transposed a lot. But when I read, if there is a mistake in a 700-page book, I'm going to find it. I have no idea how that happens. I guess, you know, the good takes over where the bad does its own thing. You know, I am not sure how that happens. It's a weird thing to me. I want to also ask you about your titles for your books, because your first book is so adorable. When you decided to call this book, let me get it right, One Coffee With. That was the first, that was the name on the first draft. Anyway, I'm assuming it stayed.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that you really kind of leave it dangling there. You don't really say exactly what it's going to be about, and it almost forces the reader to go and figure out, what the heck was she talking about? It's a really great little enticement from the author. And I have to tell you, I know sometimes, just from I read almost 400 books a year, so I know from reading that, I don't have a TV or much of a social life, so, you know, I live with cats and books. What can I tell you, Margaret? It's my life. But
and you don't have to walk the cats.
I don't have to walk cats. Thank you, Lord, for giving me five beautiful cats who want to sleep all day. But I do know that some titles are taken right out of books, right out of a line in the book, and they're so perfect. And other titles, I think, where the heck did that come from? That makes no sense to me whatsoever. I'll read the book, and I can't figure out where the title comes from. It makes no sense to me. Is titling a book an important part of your finished product?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely so. The One Coffee With came from, do you want it with or without, meaning milk and sugar. And
sure.
But in this case, it's One Coffee With potassium dichromate.
Right.
I love that. And the next one, the funny thing about the next one, I forget what I wanted to call it, but it wasn't working out. And finally, I remembered in one image that Sigrid thinks that the corpse, when she saw the woman lying on the floor, dead, that it was like a butterfly pinned to a specimen type thing. So I called it Death of a Butterfly. That title came long after the book was finished. But I had one reviewer say, well, I had just belabored the whole point and had tried to make it, make that character more of a butterfly and blah, 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 blah. And I really, you never talk back to a reviewer. I have never written to a reviewer and taken issue. You don't win in a case like that, whether they like it or they hate it. And so I really wanted to say, I didn't get the title until after the book was finished, but you can't say that.
No, you really can't. And you know something? And I'm sure after all the books and the reviews, you recognize the fact that sometimes it's just not someone's cup of tea. And you're never going to make them happy. And, I oftentimes look at my guest reviews on Amazon, and when I see bad reviews, I'll go and see what that reviewer has also reviewed. And 9 out of 10 times, that person is a negative reviewer. They're a troll. I think that comes just with the business. It's part of writing books.
It is.
And,
and also, taste is such a subjective thing, Pam.
Oh,
taste
gosh,
is very subjective. And what one person likes, another person won't. And so I don't expect to appeal to everybody. But the one time I really had trouble was with the third Deborah Knott book that was set down at the coast. And I was complaining to Marilyn Wallace. I don't know if you remember her. She was a really fine writer from California who wound up being in New York. But anyhow, so I was complaining to Marilyn. I said, I can't think of a title of this book. She said, well, what's it about? And I said, well, it's down at the coast, and it's about this Harker's Island people who are very independent and don't like to be told what they can do or not. And I said, loons are on the endangered list down there, and yet they'll go out and they'll be shooting at loons every time because they like stewed loons.
Can I raise my hand? I know it is. I know what it is. It's shooting at loons. It was a great book.
She said, there's your title, Shooting at Loons. And then when I was doing the furniture market over in High Point, because most of these Deborah Knott judge, and so I send her across North Carolina to hold court in different places. And so when I sent her to High Point, it was the scene of the furniture market, the international furniture market over there. And when I was researching it over and over, I kept hearing people say, oh, we're going to have a killer market this year, killer market. And I thought, oh, boy, there's my title.
There's your title. How funny. I love that. I love the fact that, you're listening to what people are saying and you're pulling it out of there. I want to just take a moment to let everybody know that I'm speaking with Margaret Maron, who has won every major crime fiction award there is. More even than I announced at the beginning of the show, she's done it all. She's received it all. She's an amazing author. And if you'd like to say hello to Margaret, you may call in now at 347-633-9609. Margaret's new book is called Takeout. It is probably Sigrid's last book that you're going to read, and that's coming up in the show next. Let me remind you, it's 347-633-9609. I guess, Margaret, the most stunning news of the evening is that you're going to not write novels anymore, or at least you don't think you are. Your plan is
to...
Your plan is to not write full-length novels. Right. And short stories have now come into their own and are exceptionally popular again. What made you decide to step away from writing full-length novels?
Well, Pam, I tell you, it's hard to say exactly, but one of the reasons is that I felt like I had said everything that needed to be said about these two characters, whom I have enjoyed knowing over the years, but I didn't want to keep repeating myself, and I didn't want to have them doing the same thing over and over. I just felt like maybe I had stayed long enough at the dance, and I didn't want to stay too long. I didn't want people to say, oh, you know, she used to write good books, but, oh, have you seen these last few? I didn't want that. And I have been very lucky. The reviewers have been very kind. They say I'm going out at the top of my game, and I hope that's true.
Well, I think that that is true. However, you know, let me just put a bug in your ear, even though I'm sure you're aware of this, but you can always write another standalone and leave your characters go, because I know you've kind of wrapped up stories on them, and that's a wonderful thing to do. I was talking to someone the other night, and perhaps you'll agree with this. There are writers that both you and I know who have written the same character their entire career with, you know, maybe a standalone here and there. And you think, oh, my God, they've saved the world 24 times. How many more times are they going to save the world or save the president? Or, you know, when is it going to end? There's no change. Everything's the same. It's just another adventure. And you want to say, okay, and here's the funny thing, and I think you'll agree that readers get addicted to certain writers. If it's somebody they love, they fall in love with them, they buy the books over and over again. God bless them. Good for the writer. But if you want variety in your life as a writer and a reader, you, I think you want to taste a little bit of everything, Margaret. Is that not, or am I getting it wrong from a writer's standpoint?
No, you're getting it quite right.
The
thing is that my characters are not static. They change and grow over the course of the series. Although each book can be treated as a standalone, I think it's a richer experience if you start at the beginning. Start at the beginning and go read straight through. It'll be a slightly richer experience. I mean, with the Sigrid Harrell book, she starts off as a loner, very prickly nature. She doesn't care anything about clothes. She doesn't care anything about music. She does like poetry. But she doesn't have much of a family, just her mother and a distant cousin, and a grandmother, a North Carolina grandmother, as a matter of fact. But she's basically a loner, and she's very competent in her job, and she's very incompetent in personal relationships. So over the course of the book, over this 1 year that I gave her, she is going to meet a famous artist, older man, who is intrigued by her, by her prickly character and everything. I sort of compared it to that she's like one of those Chinese puzzle boxes that it takes patience and perseverance to unlock. And Oscar Naumann had the patience and the perseverance, and he unlocked it. And they were it was a wonderful start to a relationship. Unfortunately, he's killed in a car crash toward the end of the series. In fact, I had one friend who said, I'm not reading that book. I am not reading that book. She said, as long as I don't read it, he will still be alive. And
but isn't it
and
brave?
And I thought that was sweet.
But it's brave to kill off a major character, I think. I think it really it takes a brilliant writer to say, I'm willing to risk a major character to make the story change. And because this is life. Life happens. There are deaths of people we love.
I will tell you this, Pam. Part of it was, at the time that I was writing these books, there were so many macho, you know, as president of Sisters in Crime, I was very much aware of how many people, how many men resented us and resented women
right.
writers.
Yes.
And I had gotten
yes.
to the point that I really didn't want to hear, you know, I did not want to read one more time about mutilation of a woman's body. And
oh, thank you.
And I noticed that these male characters, series characters, that if they had a romantic interest in this particular book, she would either prove to be the killer or she would be dead at the end of the book so that he could love and lust again in the next book. And I thought, no, if you love somebody, you do not get over their death that quickly. And so
exactly.
when I killed off her lover, the next book was showing how she did mourn, how she was almost paralyzed with grief and yet had to carry on and stay with her job as a homicide detective. But yet,
because isn't that life,
grief
Margaret?
Permeated,
that's life.
Grief permeated that book, yeah, yeah.
It becomes the new normal, just like in real life. I'm so glad that you did that, too, because... it's more realistic, and I think it's more relatable. And
I hope
you know, so.
So
I really believe that. Good on you. I love when there's a major character that something happens that takes you totally out of your comfort zone, and that's essentially what it is. Your friend who's
yeah.
saying I'm not going to read it because I don't want to, you know, it's still a lot. It's out of her comfort zone, and I get that,
I was just going to say that when I told my agent, I said, you know, Oscar's going to die in this book. And there's a long silence. And she goes, oh, no, no. But yes.
But that's reality. I mean, you're not writing supernatural mm-hmm. or anything like that or paranormal. So, you know, and it's a good thing because I suspect when I do go back and read all of the books in order, I'm going to see that there's a lot of growth and there's a lot of stumbling blocks, but there's still a lot of growth. And you probably, well, I know you are because I know you're writing, that you are revealing more and more and more about this character each mm-hmm. time. Not only the growth, but we're learning more about her and her modus operandi. Maybe that's the way to say it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes, yes,
yeah.
exactly. In fact, that's yeah. why I wanted to write Takeout. I had when I finished with the Deborah Knott books, I had written a book. Her mother was like a small-town debutante who married
right.
a bootlegger with eight small boys. And I had never really explored how and why, how they met and why they wound up married. And that was what Long Upon the Land was. And that gave the backstory to Deborah's parents. And of course, they formed her as to what she was. So having done that, I thought, you know, there were still some loose ends left in the Sigrid Harrell books. And I had been getting letters from my readers saying, I mean, most of them prefer the Deborah Knott books to the Sigrid Harrell. She's not as warm and fuzzy a character as Deborah is.
I like
but for
Prickly,
those,
though.
But
I like
for those
Prickly.
Who like Prickly, I do
right.
have many people who prefer her. And they wanted to know how she's getting along. And so the book was written for my readers, that particular book. Also, I did have some loose ends that I needed to tie off. And that gave me a chance to do it.
And you know something, isn't that a lovely way to end a series? Margaret, I want to ask you a few other questions, just generally. But when you look back on your writing career,
mm-hmm.
do you look back at your first book with love? Like, this is my first baby, and maybe I didn't do so well as it did with the last baby, but I still love this baby as much. Or do you wish you could go back and say, oh, no, let me take him out of that awful mess of clothes that I put him on and put her in something nice, you know. What is your, when you look back?
I do have an affection for the books, Pam, I must say. But the thing is, you're quite right. My husband is fond of saying about paintings. He said a painting is never finished. It's abandoned. You take it to a certain point. And he has ruined a couple of good paintings that I love because he just wouldn't leave it alone. He kept on until he just took it past the point. And the balance, it just toppled over at that point. And so I make the best book I can. And I recognize it for what it is. I usually hate my books when I first finish them. It takes about, 3 months until I can get a distance on them enough to say, well, you know, maybe that wasn't too bad.
By the by, can I just mention that they were never too bad? You won a bunch of awards.
You've
been given a lot of accolades, including the Grand Master. So congratulations on that. I want to
thank
ask
you. I've been very lucky.
Well, you know, I think readers have been very lucky to have these fabulous books in their midst, and you know, I look forward to your short stories. But I want to ask you some other things. You live in a beautiful part of North Carolina. I happened to be up there for BoucherCon when it was in Raleigh. I did not go last year to New Orleans when you were given your lifetime achievement. But what do you do besides write and watch your husband paint fabulous art? What do you like
to
do? What do you do for fun?
I read. I have a wide circle of friends here. I have two granddaughters in the area. You know, it's just life. It's just life. And I grow flowers and
how wonderful.
What can I say? You know, it's just, there's an expression we have down here, and maybe you know it too, about being in the short rows. Do you know what that means?
Yes. Yes,
for
of
instance,
course.
Yeah, when you have a long, hard field that you've got to chop the corn to get the grass out of the corn, and those long, long rows in the middle of the field. But most fields are irregularly shaped, and so as you pass on past the long rows, then the next thing, you're in the short rows. And that's where I feel like my husband and I are right now. We're in the short rows.
How lovely.
We know it.
What a great way to explain it.
And we're just enjoying it.
I think that's fabulous. I really do. I love that. Is there a book that is your one book, or maybe one of two or one of many, that you will always read more than once?
I myself, somebody else's books? Yes. I read Jane Austen. I guess I've read Pride and Prejudice at least once every 2 or 3 years since the first time I read it. And one of my favorite books is Rumor Garden's China Court. Do you know it?
Yes. Yes, I do.
I love that book, except for that one thing at the end where the man slaps his, where he slaps her, and I think, you know, that but that was of the day and period, and I just have to overlook that. But the whole book as a whole, I have gone back and reread that book several times, and each time I discover something new in it.
Margaret, whose book are you reading right now?
Whose book am I reading right now? Well, I have to say, I've just finished Al Franken's Giant of the Senate.
I heard it was wonderful.
It was. It was. I really enjoyed it. And my publisher is the one, Hachette, published it.
Right.
And so they sent me a copy. That's the nice thing about being a writer, is that you can get your publisher to send you. I mean, I get Marcia Mahler's books. For instance, she always
says,
well,
can I tell you, it's a good
editor.
Thing about being a talk show host, too. You get a lot of books to read. And when you read as much as I do, it's a wonderful thing. It is an embarrassment of riches.
Pam, tell me this. If you open a book and you start reading and you don't like it, do you feel compelled to finish it?
No, I won't. But I'll tell you why. Because a book has to grab me right away, and even if the storyline looks interesting, and then I meet the characters, and they're not, I don't feel anything for them, whether it's disdain, love, sympathy, understanding, empathy, whatever it happens to be. If I can't feel a character, I can't read the book. I'll tell you another thing, and maybe you'll tell me, because you've been writing for so long, and I have tried to explain this to writer friends of mine, but when you write from many points of view, if your characters do not have a distinctive voice, a distinctive cadence, a distinctive timbre, a distinctive set of words that are only theirs, it's mind-numbing to me, because if I don't know who the character is, who's speaking, or if the dialogue or the exchange is interchangeable, that ruins it. Does that make sense to you, Margaret, as a writer?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have to hear the voice. One of my characters in one of my books, for instance, never used contractions. When I wrote her dialogue, I never used an apostrophe, because she never used contractions. And that gave her speech a certain formality that no other character in that book had.
I have to tell you, I love that kind of language, by the way. I do love reading. When I think of nobility. I also think of paranormal, because I read across genres. So I love reading that, and also, since I'm a science fiction geek, it kind of reminds me of Data from Star Trek, and I really like that character a lot too. So maybe that's what it is. How interesting is that? What do you think is the most important tool in your writer's toolbox?
Oh, you mean imagination, or tricks that I use? Well, one thing that I use very, very often is Roget's Thesaurus. And I'm not talking about the one that you find on your computer. I have never found a synonym that worked for me on the computer. I have to have the dictionary Roget, the one that's organized by ideas. Yeah.
Yes.
The traditional organization of that book. And I use it constantly, because if you don't have the correct word, the correct nuance that you're looking for, I mean, I have spent hours looking for just the right one and can't find it. And there it is, finally. And then, I can use it and move on.
And it does push you forward, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. It really does. Also, you're talking about science fiction. Now, I forget which science fiction it was. It was one of the classic ones. And I always want to give it to Heinlein, but I don't think it was him. But it was a very good piece of writing advice. And he said, try to give your character an awareness of something besides the sense of sight. What is your character smelling? What is your character hearing? What is your character tasting? Something besides just what the character sees. And, you know, it really does work.
It does. It's so much richer, isn't it? It's so much richer.
Yes, yes. You get a sense of place, too. That was one of the things that I used to do when I was giving writing seminars. I would say, everybody, take this room and write from it from two different viewpoints, and they could pick whatever they wanted. For instance, if they picked a rich woman, the first thing she would notice is how shabby the room was. If they picked the migrant farm worker, she would look at that room and think that it was comfortable and well appointed and everything. And then if you had a blind person describing that room, you wouldn't have anything that would be sight. It would all be touch and smell and hearing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Interesting. My last question to you, and you have been amazing to stay with me this long. I don't know how you feel, but it's flown by for me. I want to ask you, when you look at your early self and you look at where you are right now as a writer, what have you learned about yourself, Margaret?
probably not enough.
Do we ever?
Hard question to answer. I do know that I am a storyteller. It used to drive my husband crazy when, you know, I come out of the South, which has a rich storytelling tradition.
Rich
I can remember being a child sitting on the porch on summer nights, batting away the mosquitoes because we didn't have air conditioning, and listening to the adults talk and telling family stories or telling stories about neighbors or gossip, I mean, whatever, and just listening to that richness. And I think I learned to shape a story by that. So after we were married, we came back to the States. I ran through a stop sign on one of the roads there in Brooklyn, and I came home to tell my husband. I said, you know, I didn't see that stop sign, even though I've been there. And he stopped me. He said, wait, was there blood? Were the police called? And, you know, he just stepped all over my punchline. I mean, it just, and I had to learn to tell him, no blood, no police. Now let me tell you the story. And then he would listen.
There you go. I love that. Margaret Maron, who you are magnificent. I have so enjoyed our conversation. Listeners, Margaret has won every major American award for mysteries, including the Edgar, the Anthony, the Agatha, that's McCavity. She has served as the head of every major crime writing and mystery organization there is. She's been recognized for her books throughout the country and throughout the world. It is kind of a tearful way I want to say goodbye to you, because you're not going to be writing novels anymore. But thank you again. We are friends on Facebook. You and I are going to talk again, aren't we?
I just wanted to invite you to come.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that keep your eye out for Ellery Queen, because they've got two of my short stories in their queue to be printed in the next year.
I absolutely will. And I'd like to turn around and offer you the microphone to sit behind it as a guest host one evening and invite one of your writer friends on. Allow me to be your tech for the night. Wouldn't that be fun?
That might be interesting. Yes, we'll have to talk about it.
We shall. Ladies and gentlemen, Margaret Maron, I just think you're magnificent, and I've so enjoyed talking to you, Margaret. I can't thank you enough so much for being here. And I also want to thank my sponsor for tonight's show, Down and Out Books, celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction. Find out more at www.downandoutbooks.com. This is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Margaret Maron, you're the best. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Pam.
Good night, everyone. You're welcome, and good night, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Bye.